consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950. By now, the listening audience should be well familiar of what I'm about to say. WBAI is attempting to raise funds to make sure that, one, the transmitter tower, which is located at 4 Times Square, is funded so we could continue on broadcasting the content that we offer on a regular basis. That broadcast stretches out to 90 miles, a 90-mile radius. And second, we need to pay the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where WBAI's studio is located. Now, the transmitter fund, we're 2 months behind the rent. The studio rent is 3 months behind. The transmitter is $17,000 a month. The studio rent is $10,000 a month. And as I said before, we are behind on both of those things, which means now is the time to show your support to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. Give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. And also, I keep forgetting to mention this website where you can donate as well. TowerFund.WBAI.org. TowerFund.WBAI.org is where you can go and show your support as well. As I've said to you before, I only mention these things based out of necessity. I was told by management to mention these things, and clearly, if I am making an appeal to the listening audience at this moment in time before we go into the next program, which happens to be Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz, clearly we are in a dire situation. Let us not pretend that we can't handle bad news. Okay? People who are listening to WBAI are adults. There's no need to sugarcoat things. Okay? No need to mask the situation that we're in. WBAI is in debt, and we need the listening audience to help us right now. Now, historically, that has been a precedence on the listening audience to support this radio station. And if we appeal to the listening audience in a honest manner, we will succeed. But we need to understand that there is an ecosystem here at WBAI. We provide you, we being the producers here at WBAI, provide you content. The listeners listen. And if you appreciate what you have heard, you sustain us financially. That's how it works. That's how an ecosystem works. So we're behind, but with the help of listeners like yourselves, we could make it happen. 212-209-2950. Or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I just said it and I forgot. And now I have to remember again. TowerFund.WBAI.org. TowerFund.WBAI.org. Okay, it's 4 minutes past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz. That's coming up. Stay tuned.
live in a political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times where men commit crimes, and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world. Icicles hanging down. Wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground.
Good evening, everyone. This is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice on WBAI. FM 99.5 and WBAI.org. And I want to second everything that Reggie just said. People might remember back in 2019, it wasn't that long ago, 2 years, somebody in the leadership of Pacifica, who shall remain unnamed, lest he sue me for defamation, took WBAI's programming off the air. And we were off for 4 weeks and people missed us. We had rallies at City Hall. Eric Adams spoke out. The mayor at the time, de Blasio, spoke out. And when we got back on the air, thanks to a lawsuit that yours truly brought, we had the biggest month of fundraising ever in the history of, or at least in 15 years at WBAI. We raised $200,000 in 1 month. Just think about it. Just think about what I was already saying, that what if we had to go off the air because we didn't have money? And there are people trying to take us off the air every day. There is a petition at the FCC pending for somebody who doesn't like us to take WBAI off the air, to cancel our license. So, and we got to pay lawyers for that, not me. And just remember that. We need people to, just like you give to your favorite candidate and they raise tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. Just like you put money in every month for Netflix and Hulu and Apple TV and whatever else you pay your $7 to $15 a month for, do it for WBAI. Go to BAI.org, become a WBAI buddy, give $25 a month, give up, you know, two slices of pizza and a can of soda. Or if you go to a cheap place, four slices of pizza and four cans of soda. We need your support. Now, I'm going to talk quickly because we're running tight today. There is an election on Tuesday. I hope everybody is going to vote. I can't tell you who I'm going to vote for, but there's a governor's election where Cuomo's right-hand woman is running against Jermoni Williams and Tom Suozzi. And Jermoni Williams, who's the only one of those three, who's been a longtime friend of WBAI. And Anna Maria Archila is running against Congressman Delgado and a third candidate whose name slips my mind. important to vote. And there are other local races. Elections matter. We learned that with Trump. Now, one of the things that happens because Democrats can get piggish, just like Republicans, is a judge, or actually the New York State Court of Appeals, threw out the district lines that the Democrats drew for Congress and State Senate. And those elections are not going to happen until August. And one of the crazy things that happened, one of many crazy things that happened, is that they created a new 10th congressional district. There was a 10th congressional district, which used to be like the west side of Manhattan below 100th Street. Now it's 14th Street. And so it's Greenwich Village, Soho, Tribeca, Brooklyn Heights, Park Slope, and some parts of Brooklyn south of Park Slope. It's probably the most liberal district in America. Or at least close to the one that Maxine Waters represents in Berkeley and Oakland. And there's no incumbent. So there are 15 people running, 15 candidates running. Last night, I had the pleasure of co-emceeing a forum where six of those candidates spoke. We're going to play two of them, the two that I'm judging to be the most progressive, people in the race said, and we'll play more. And I decided I didn't include Bill de Blasio in that two most progressive people. Bill de Blasio was running for mayor, not for mayor. He's running for Congress. So we're going to listen tonight to Yulin Niu, who is presently an assembly member from Chinatown, and a bit of the Lower East Side. And then we're going to hear from Mondia Jones, who is presently a Congress member serving Rockland County, who has moved to Brooklyn and is going to be running in the 10th Congressional District. So this forum was produced by the New York Progressive Action Network, which I am counsel to, and Our Revolution, which is a group that was started by Bernie Sanders nationally after his 2016 campaign, which endorses candidates all over the country. So the first candidate we're going to listen to is Yulin Niu. And maybe next week we'll take some calls and see what people think of these two people. Go ahead, Reggie.
First candidate is an exciting candidate who first served as chief of staff to Assemblyman Ron Kim before she won a historic election as the first Asian American woman in the assembly, representing the 65th Assembly District. Since then, she's built a movement to fight for transparency and accountability in our government. She was named just this year by City and State as New York's second most influential Asian American lawmaker. She's a proud graduate of CUNY Baruch and a loving dog mom to Samson. That's a great name, Samson. So without any further ado, I give you Yulin, 5-minute opening.
Thank you so much for having me, George, and thanks for reminding me of all of the little structural things. But I wanted to say thank you all for being here today. I love NYPAN. I love Our Revolution. I'm really glad to be here. I'm an immigrant, a lifelong progressive. A lot of you know me already, and you may or may not hear Samson howl because he howls all the time whenever there's any kind of siren going off, so I apologize. But I am a Working Families Democrat. A lot of folks know me from actually being very, very WFP. I ran on the Working Families Party line alone, actually, for the 65th district when I first ran. And, you know, it is, you know, something that I'm very, very proud of because I've always been a consistent champion for our progressive party. And so I have devoted my life to making the government more effective, representative, and equitable and just for all of us. My parents and I actually, we immigrated to the United States from Taiwan from when I was just a baby. We moved here with just suitcases and started a new life in America. And we immigrated, you know, to one of the worst places on earth, honestly. That was just, you know, we probably saw it on television, but people were arrested for trying to riot at Pride. It was Moscow, Idaho, in that area. So I just want to say that, you know, my parents, they chose some places, but I chose New York. I'm also proud to say that I'm a proud CUNY Baruch graduate, and I've been fighting for the people of New York for more than a decade. I have worked on the state level of government for over 20 years now. And in New York, I served as you know, George has said, chief of staff to Assemblymember Ron Kim for several years. And in 2016, I was elected to represent New York's 65th Assembly District in Lower Manhattan. And obviously, you know, I have always represented marginalized people of color. And in this district, you know, we have been redrawn to connect Manhattan and Brooklyn Chinatowns, and where the AAPI population actually doubled from 10% to over 22%. And at a time where AAPI New Yorkers are the fastest growing demographic. And I want to continue to work alongside all of my progressive friends and fam to be able to continue the fight to make sure that we have representation, diversity, and perspective and lenses in our halls of government. You know, we all know that those closest to the pain should be closest to the power. And so we have to continue to fight alongside one another to make sure that we're having that representation. I'm running for Congress in District 10 because this is my home. The people who live here are my neighbors, and no one knows who we are what we need and how to fight for our community better than we do. And in the 6 years, I have obviously been very representative of my district, listened to this community's needs and been an active part of this community and been side by side with this community on so many different fights. You know, we continue to have fought for obviously a lot of the things that we have, you know, wanted for all of us, right? Healthcare, housing, all of the things that we constantly talk about when it comes to social services needs. You know, and you've seen me be very, very courageous when it comes to fighting for our working families, fighting to make sure that we have a budget that reflects our values, the things that we care about. And I have stood up against corruption, whether it is Governor Cuomo or whether it is, you know, our own leadership when we have to, you know, fight to, you know, be heard on the issues that we care about. And we have to make sure that we are unflinching when it comes to standing up for the things that we believe in. And I think that I have shown to that political courageousness. Ana Marta, like she told us just now, you know, all of the things that we want in a leader. And I think that, you know, it's important to embody that every step of the way. The community deserves a representative who actually, you know, embodies that courage. And I've been fighting for New Yorkers for over a decade and know this community's needs like the back of my hand. The district knows me because I have fought alongside them for years, from fighting alongside us for immigrant legal services to criminal justice reform to making sure that we have healthy food for all of us. And, you know, even, you know, took the time to make sure that we were on hunger strike with our taxi drivers, making sure that we got arrested alongside airport workers. We have to make sure that we are fighting for folks, and it takes courage to stand up for justice. And I always have, and regardless of what it costs politically or who, you know, and what it costs to myself, I have to make sure to stand up. So thank you so much.
Thank you. The first question is on healthcare, and it's going to be asked by Arthur Schwartz, our legal counsel, treasurer, and moral guidepost. Arthur, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Luke and Yulin. You heard that, moral guidepost.
I love it.
Okay. So in Congress, one of the most important bills, in our opinion, that issues that you're going to be asked to work on is Medicare for All. There is a House version of Senator Sanders' Medicare for All bill that was introduced by Representative Jayapal, H.R. 1384. The first question is, will you support it? But the second question, because we know you're going to say yes, the second question is, what will you do to fight for its enactment as a congressperson? And the third question is, I know you supported the New York Health Act, but if you're in Congress, what will you do to push the adoption of the New York Health Act, even though you're in Congress? So it's a two-part question. What will you do to fight for the Jayapal bill? And second, what will you do to try to get New York Health Act passed?
So first off, I will support it. So yes, you are correct. I will answer yes. And then second, you know, what I will do to fight for the enactment. Obviously, I think that it's all about coalition building, whether or not it is, you know, something that people are fighting for. It's about moving hearts and minds. It's about building coalitions. You cannot do anything without a coalition of people. And I will say that, you know, I'm very, very proud to have moved hearts and minds during the time when Cuomo was trying to enact a austerity budget, as folks know. And we got so close. We got close enough to make it so that with one vote, we could have overturned the budget. And that was something that I will say was very significant. And I think that it's always about coalition building, making sure that we're talking to one another, and building enough power to be able to be unignored. I think that that's really what it is. And I think that, you know, I will continue to you know, be as thoughtful in my coalition building as I have been in the assembly. And I will continue to help to build power for our progressive movement and also for making sure that we have the New York Health Act as well passed. Because one of the things that I think that the federal government can do is to make things easier on the state to be able to get, you know, what the pieces, what pieces are missing to get to the places that we know are the places that we should be going. One of the biggest fights on the New York Health Act is cost. And I think that a lot of people will say like, oh, you know, it doesn't, you know, it saves more money than it costs. But that's on our side. But a lot of times people will be like, well, the initial cost is going to be very, very heavy for the state. And I think that that's where the federal government can come in to make sure that the New York Health Act is enacted.
George, back to you.
Thank you, Ewing. The next question, which I guess I'll ask, has to do with the defense budget, which if you're in Congress, you have to deal with. It's in the background of us, our country just concluding a 20-year war in Afghanistan, during which our military killed tens of thousands of civilians and resulted in the same regime in power that was when we first got involved there. And then, of course, we had the Iraq War, which was 15 years, in which our leaders intentionally lied to Congress and the people to gain their support. We're now sending billions upon billions to Ukraine, becoming increasingly more involved in a dangerous war and continuing to fund tyrants and aggressors around the world. As a result, our so-called defense budget, which is supported by both parties, is now greater than the combined defense budgets of the next 10 largest countries. And it dwarfs all U.S. spending on human needs. The question is, what's your position? What would your position be on the defense budget? Will you vote for more, less, or the same amount of spending?
I would vote for less. I mean, as the numbers you just said, you know, one of the biggest things that we have gone through worldwide is a health pandemic. One of the things that we desperately need to fund is healthcare. I think that it's really important that we're actually making sure that we're spending on our people and investing in our communities and investing in our country so that we can have in a lot of ways, you know, good defense, right? And I think that, you know, one would say that if you're healthier, then you're probably also making your country healthier as a whole. And I think that that's really one of the things that we should be all talking about. And I think that, you know, even with the spending, I think that there has been, you know, not the kinds of results that we have anticipated that our country should be having from that spending as well. So I think that one of the best things that we can do is to make sure that we're investing in our own people.
Great. The next question is on education. Is Jake Jacobs on?
Hi, I'm here. Yeah.
Great. You want to ask that question, Jake? Jake is a teacher in the public school system in the Bronx, right?
That's right. I teach in District 11 in the Bronx, finishing up my 14th year. And my question is concerning charter schools. This is for all the candidates. As a member of Congress, there is a fund for new charter schools. It's called CSP, the Charter Schools Program. And they spend about $440 million a year allocating money that goes to charter schools. And that program has had a very, very dubious record where over 30% of the money historically has gone to charter schools that either never opened or quickly failed. So my question is, on the federal level, would you support efforts to eliminate the funding, reduce the funding? Would you support the funding? What is your view on federal funding for charters? And in general, do you support charter schools? Would you sign on as a member to the NAACP moratorium on charter schools that siphon money from public schools? What's your position?
My position has always been, and this is the state position I've taken, and also I'm going to take the same position on the federal level because I truly, truly believe it as a public school kid through and through, from all the way from pre-K all the way to my postgraduate degrees. So I will say that, you know, public dollars should always be going to our public schools. I think that it is really, really crucial. And as somebody who, folks probably know this, but I am on the spectrum. I have a learning disability, but I think that it's really important for folks to understand that we should be funding programs like the IDEA, that we should be making sure that our teachers who are, you know, special education teachers are able to be able to teach in our schools. We don't cream. Our public schools don't cream. They are able to teach everyone. And it's really, really important for all of our students to be able to have a quality education. And we need to make sure that we're funding that. Our public dollars should always be going to our public schools.
Maria?
All right, so now we're on to question four. So our question four is about our fight for democracy. It's one of the things that, you know, I know every single one of us on this call has been impacted by in the most recent days and the years, especially, you know, given Trump's presidency. So, you know, even before the GOP packed the current Supreme Court, it spent the last 30 years undercutting our limited democracy, including Citizens United decision, allowing unlimited corporate spending, striking down the Voting Rights Act, approving partisan gerrymandering and Jim Crow voting restrictions, et cetera. Now the GOP has become officially a pro-terrorist, anti-democratic party intent on ending free elections while mass murder is condoned and our right to privacy, including reproductive freedom, has stayed left. On top of that, our planet is on life support. We have so many issues going on that are impacting our democracy. So given these existential threats, what can you as a member of Congress do to save our democracy?
There are so many things we can do. I just wish that we would do them. You know, there are so many things we can be doing to hold people accountable, and we can make sure that we are, you know, regulating, you know, so many different things. We can attack corruption. We can tax the rich by making them pay their fair share. We can deliver healthcare and affordable healthcare for all. We can make sure that we are advocating for our immigrant families and friends. And we can, you know, fund our public education system. We can fully fund our public housing. We can make sure that we are combating hate and bigotry and all of these things by, you know, passing the laws that will protect us and stop terrorism. You know, like actual domestic terrorism is happening right now in this country every single day. Like it's frightening. We need to make sure that we are, you know, passing a Green New Deal. You know, I think that we need to be making sure that we have, you know, infrastructure changes for, you know, for so many of our school buildings, for example, with these public school Green New Deal. We have to make sure that we are investing in social services and redefining what community safety looks like. We need to make sure that we are protecting a person's right to choose. And I think that we are making sure that we have to make sure that we are also ensuring, you know, LGBTQ rights, especially trans rights, you know, this is human rights. Like we could be protecting human rights. We could also be, you know, doing things like taking the asset limits off of our social services, like and social benefits, right? We could be doing things that will transform the way that we think about things. I mean, my mom tells me all the time, like, you're a WIC baby. Remember, you're a WIC baby. You know, we could be like making sure that our programs are getting the funding that they deserve. And then on top of that, expanding it so that there's like no more stigma and everybody can have access to it in a way that will actually, you know, help people. We have to fix these broken institutions and expand our democracy. And thank you so much for the question. We can do so much. I wish that we would do it. That's all. And I promise that when I get there, that's like all I will be doing.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, that question was packed. So thank you for your answer. I'm going to send it back to George for the last question.
Thank you.
So the last question has to do somewhat related defense of human rights, particularly in the Middle East. And our country's elections. You know, many progressives of all backgrounds have been deeply disturbed by recent attacks on progressive journalists, academics, and political leaders who have spoken out against human rights abuses. And we see that we are funding a government in Israel that is intent on an illegal annexation of lands on the West Bank. Particularly disturbing in this is the role of a group called AIPAC, which has interfered in several congressional elections, falsely accusing progressives like Nina Turner and Cisneros, who narrowly lost her election. They falsely accused them of being anti-Semitic just because they spoke out in favor of the human rights violations that have been committed. Fortunately, in our district, we have a lot, in CD10, we have a lot of members of J Street and the Jewish Vote, which are a counterweight to AIPAC. I'm curious, what's your position on this trend, and do you support the group AIPAC?
So I will say that, first and foremost, all human rights violations should be something that nobody ever condones. This is something that... it's not anti-Semitic to say that you don't condone human rights violations. It is really, really key. And I think that one of the things that you were mentioning about, you know, about funds being used, our tax dollars have to be monitored and also be very transparent, right? So I don't think that that's something that, I know that there was a bill, McCollum, I believe Eddie McCollum has a bill that makes it so that we just basically get to see where our funds go. And I think that that's a very basic transparency bill that is a very good bill. I think that that would also help to answer a lot of questions for a lot of folks on, you know, how the, you know, I believe it's like over $3 billion that are, you know, given, are spent. And I think that it's really important that we have that visibility. And I think that, you know, our taxpayers probably also need to know whether or not anything is being used that they're paying for. You know, it's not violating human rights. And I think that, you know, folks probably don't know this about me. I've talked about it now because I'm running for Congress on occasion, and I still am a little bit hesitant to, because it upsets me. I went to college with Rachel Corey at Evergreen State College. And as people know, she was protecting Palestinian homes when she was bulldozed to death. And so I think I have a little bit of a lens into some of the pain there. And I will say that it's really important that we are fighting for human rights everywhere. And, you know, and that's going to be everywhere. It's global, right? I mean, right now we can talk about the Islamophobia that's happening in China. We can talk about the Islamophobia that's happening across the, you know, across our country, right? Critiquing your own government isn't hatred towards others. It's critiquing your government for what they're doing to other people.
Thank you so much for your very sincere, heartfelt answer. Appreciate that. Now you have 1 minute for a closing statement, right on time. You're on.
So I guess I would just say that I know folks are wanting to make a, you know, choice right now. And it's an important choice because we have a very open seat in New York 10. I know that I have a very large and wide path to get there. But it's not just about the fact that I have the largest and widest and brightest path right now. It's about the fact that I know that we will get there if we fight together and build a coalition so large and so loud that no one can ignore us. I know that works because I built those winning coalitions to protect workers and our neighborhoods during my time in Albany. And I will continue to fight alongside you. And I know that people want to know that I'm always going to be accessible, always going to be reachable. And I will be. I have been, and I will continue to be. And we are going to be fighting for accountability We are fighting for accessibility. We are fighting for transparency, and we are fighting for a more just New York and a more just country. And for all of the over 700 volunteers committed to now 4,500 hours of volunteer time, we have a field operation that is already out there knocking doors, talking to people, and we have a knowledge of this district that no one can match. And I know that, you know, you want a representative that's going to make sure to speak for the people.
That was the end of Yulee Nu's statement. We're going to go very quickly into the next candidate. This is Arthur Schwartz and Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM. We are in WBAI.org, pushing you to make a contribution. We were listening to clips from a forum held last night by the New York Progressive Action Network. And the next candidate we're going to hear from is a fellow named Mondaire Jones, who presently is a congressperson from Rockland County, but who has moved to Brooklyn and is running in the new 10th Congressional District, which includes Manhattan, south of 14th Street, Brooklyn Heights, Park Slope, and Borough Park. So here is Mondaire Jones.
We want to open with you making a statement of anything you want to talk about for 5 minutes.
Thank you. Well, George, thank you for that introduction. And let me just state how I regret having to reschedule until later this evening this interview. I am so thrilled and honored, frankly, by the opportunity to interview with you once again. This is an organization that has endorsed my improbable campaign for Congress before, back in 2020, when Washington's political establishment certainly didn't think that someone like me could make it to Congress. And you all believed in me, and I'm so grateful to you for that. And I hope you have seen that I have been a progressive champion in Congress already. I'm Mondaire Jones, and I'm running for re-election to the House in what is now New York's newly drawn 10th Congressional District. It is a district with which I have a special connection. Growing up, my family didn't have it easy. I was raised in Section 8 housing and on food stamps by a young single mom who, like so many incredible women throughout New York City, still had to work multiple jobs to provide for our family. And she got help raising me from my grandparents. My grandfather was a janitor and my grandmother cleaned homes. And when daycare was too expensive, she took me to work with her. I also grew up closeted in the Baptist church, where things have gotten better, but it's still taboo to be gay. And it is because of all of these experiences that I never imagined someone like me could run for Congress, let alone make history back in 2020, when I was elected our nation's first openly gay Black member of Congress. And I know that I did that with the help of you and this organization. Well, it was the neighborhoods in New York's 10th Congressional District that allowed me to make that history, because they helped shape me into the person that I am today. And not just because I worked in the district as a young lawyer, but because as a young person, this district showed me how to accept who I am and to live an authentic life as an openly gay man. When I was still closeted, I found refuge in the West Village, where I saw queer people of color living lives unlike anything I had ever imagined. And it was through my experiences in the district, which, as you know, is Lower Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn, that I found the courage to come out to my family, my friends, my classmates, and my colleagues. And I am so proud, as I mentioned earlier, to be running, to be a progressive champion for a district that has given so much to me. And I've got a strong track record to run on, because I'm already, as I also mentioned, a progressive champion in Congress. And I'm proud to be endorsed, by the way, by organizations like the Congressional Progressive Caucus PAC and Democracy for America, as well as some labor unions like RWDSU and National Nurses United. Last year, I helped pass the American Rescue Plan, which cut child poverty in half, brought billions of dollars to New York City schools and to our city government and the state, kept small businesses open and their employees on the payroll, and vaccinated a nation in the midst of a deadly pandemic. Last fall, at a time when few people thought we could pass Build Back Better through the House, due to my conservative Democratic colleagues withholding their support, I played a leading role in securing their support and getting Build Back Better passed through the House. And that House passed version included universal child care provisions that I co-authored, that I fought to include from my bill with Senator Elizabeth Warren called the Universal Child Care and Early Learning Act. And I had to defy the Democratic chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, and lead a bit of a revolt in order to secure those provisions in that final legislation, which is an example of how I not only hold my Republican adversaries accountable, but also my Democratic partners accountable. And I want to give you another example of that. Having experienced housing insecurity myself growing up, last August, when the rest of Congress had gone home on recess, I couldn't just allow the CDC's national eviction moratorium to lapse. That's why I stayed behind. I protested with AOC and Cori Bush at the Capitol steps for days, and we got the White House to reverse its position and instruct the CDC to extend that eviction moratorium, which I believe saved lives, because at least as many as 7 million people were at risk of being evicted from their homes. We know what happened next. About a month later, the Supreme Court's far-right majority struck down the CDC's extension of that moratorium. And by the way, that is one of several reasons why I had the foresight, along with Jerry Nadler, to introduce in April of 2021 a bill to add 4 seats to the Supreme Court, because I knew that we would find ourselves in this moment right now, where not only Roe v. Wade
3 seconds left.
It is poised to be overturned, but also other fundamental rights like the right to vote. Speaking of the right to vote, I'm proud to have co-authored the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act, democracy-saving legislation that passed the House, but unfortunately was filibustered in the Senate like some scene out of the civil rights era in January of this year. And I'm running to continue leading the fight, this essential fight to defend our democracy and protect the fundamental right to vote. And I'm so looking forward to having a discussion with you tonight. Thanks for having me again.
Right on time. So we have a series of 5 questions that we'll ask you, and you'll have 2 minutes to answer each question. The first question is this guy up here, Arthur Schwartz. I think you know him. Arthur.
Just so people know, I was Mondaire's election lawyer when he won in 2020, and he made me go up to Albany after the state had shut down to make sure that his petitions made it into the Board of Elections. I drove and listened to Donald Trump for 3 hours on the radio that day. It was like
I was so worried, as you know, Arthur, that we wouldn't make it onto the ballot. Right. It was enough to have to get the signatures and figure out how many you needed and whether the governor was going to reduce the number in the midst of.
Right. So let me get to the question, because we want to keep people. The first question that we have is about healthcare. And you're actually, we don't have to ask you if you're going to support. Senator Sanders, well, first, actually, I asked some of the other candidates, who did you support for president in 2020?
I voted for Bernie Sanders.
Okay. The Bernie Sanders, that's the bridge into Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has introduced Senate Bill 1129, which is his Medicare for All Act, and it's been introduced by Representative Jayapal in the House. Are you a supporter of Medicare for All? If yes, what are you doing to fight for its enactment? If not, why not?
I am, and indeed, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill. Proudly champion it, even though some of my competitors in this race don't even have platforms on their website. So it makes me wonder whether they support it. Look, we are fighting to get it passed. And one thing that I'm doing actively to make sure that we even get a vote on this on the House floor is I support other progressive candidates all across the country. So many of these folks will tell you about that. They'll tell you about the support that I've provided, my endorsements, my financial support. Because I know that it matters who you choose in a Democratic primary. And we've had real opportunities with over, I think we're at 31 Democratic retirements in the House Democratic Caucus this year, something like that, 30, 31, 32. And inevitably, you're going to have an opportunity to elect someone more progressive than their predecessor in these races, given the generational divides that exist in Congress and so on and so forth. And so I've been very active, whether it's supporting Greg Kassar or Maxwell Frost or Jasmine down in for the Eddie Bernice Johnson seat, or any number of other electeds. I endorsed Nina Turner the first time she ran, for example, and gave her money from. So that is frankly changing the composition of Congress is the single most important, most effective thing we can do to get Medicare for All passed.
30 seconds left.
And with respect to the New York Health Act, have you been pushing, have you done anything to push legislators in New York to pass that law?
I have done that. I've been vocal in support of it. I'm pretty sure I've signed on to some letters, one or more letters supporting it as well. And I've certainly made public statements in expressing support of it, using my platform to encourage my state counterparts to get behind this legislation. And I have asked leadership in the state legislature in private conversations, what is the status of passing this legislation?
Go ahead, Arthur.
I said thank you.
The second question has to do with the defense, or what we like to call the war budget. The U.S. defense budget is greater than the combined total of the next 10 countries' defense budgets, the biggest 10 country budgets. And it just increases every year by billions, and both parties support it. You know, and what is it being used for? I mean, a lot of it goes to supporting tyrants around the world. We did a 20-year war in Afghanistan, where the result was the same regime was in power as when we started. In the process, we killed millions of civilians. We had a war in Iraq where Congress was lied to, and so were the American people to support. So is your position that the defense budget should be decreased, stay the same, or increase?
I think it should be radically decreased. I was proud to vote against the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. Only about 100 or so of us, I think just over 100 of us, voted against it, which shows you how much work we need to do, how far we need to go. I think it is the size of this defense budget and a number of its provisions are a moral stain on our nation and a damning reflection of our failure to prioritize so many things that we should be doing here, building an economy that works for everybody so that everyone can live in dignity. The financial investments that will be required to finally achieve racial justice in this country, climate action, which is a larger national security threat than anything else, as the Defense Department continues to be the single largest emitter of carbon gas, of any of the federal agencies in the country. And I've actually authored amendments dealing with that and other matters that unfortunately, some did get into the NDAA, but I think most of them probably did not.
Great. The next question is on education, and Arthur will ask that one as well.
You and I actually may have intersected. You went to the Ramapo Public Schools, and I sued the Ramapo School Board. Not when you were there. And somehow you got out and made it. The first question on education has to do with charter schools. There is $440 million in the current budget to give aid to new charter schools under the CSP program. What is your position on that? And do you believe that it should be eliminated, reduced, or conditions should be placed on the funding?
So as far back as my first campaign for Congress, I endorsed the NAACP's proposed moratorium on the creation of charter schools, and I still have that position. I don't think we should be building any additional charter schools. I think that the movement for charter schools in this country has come at the cost of much-needed investments in traditional public education, and that our children have, in the aggregate, really been harmed by it. And that's not to say that there aren't some, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't some good charter schools, but I'm saying that we would be benefiting a lot more public school students were we to focus on the investments and the reforms and the transformative reforms that we need to undertake in traditional public schools. And so that's why I oppose building new charter schools. And you mentioned the CSP program, Arthur. Is that a program that was funded recently as well, or that had replenishment in the ARP? Is that the?
I'm going to plead ignorance. I filled in for somebody else on that question. The second question I want to have, just the Supreme Court yesterday came down with this horrible ruling saying that there's nothing wrong with government funding religious education. How do you see dealing with that?
We have to expand the Supreme Court. This is a decision that fell along the traditional 6-3 majority minority track. By the way, this is not a Supreme Court majority that is pro-religion and that is interested in protecting all religions. I mean, this is the Supreme Court that upheld the Muslim ban a few years ago. Okay, so this is an ethno-nationalist Supreme Court majority, Christian nationalist Supreme Court majority. And I think it's important to make that observation. And the only way to deal with this jurisprudence, this line of cases in recent years, is to change the composition of the Supreme Court. We are not going to arrive at this through, trying to logically reason with people like Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch. It will be through adding 4 seats to the Supreme Court of the United States, which is what my legislation would do, restore balance and integrity, respect for the rule of law and the will of Congress, by the way, given that the Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act, which was reauthorized nearly unanimously in the early 2006. And that's the only way to do it. It's the only way to do it. Because if we were to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate and pass additional protections, and clarify, for example,
30 seconds left.
And clarify that, Congress can, because I think that the question in the case that you just described was whether religious institutions could be denied funding, I believe was the way I read the headline. I have not read the case myself. If we were to clarify that, the Supreme Court would just strike it down anyway. That's why we got to change the composition of the court.
Your question finished, Arthur?
Yep.
So we see a pattern developing where progressives like yourself are running in elections against more traditional corporate Democrats, right? You mentioned Nina Turner race and Jessica Cisneros, who just narrowly lost to such a candidate. And it's over and over we see even Jamal Bowman case where independent PACs like APAC are organized, go on the airway, spend millions of dollars and accuse the progressives falsely of being anti-Semitic. And unfortunately, it works to defeat these candidates. So my question is, do you see this as a trend? Is it a danger to our democracy? And do you support APEC?
So there are multiple parts to that question. I see the role that big money has played in our politics as being pernicious to our democracy. And that's multiple organizations doing independent expenditures to arrive at policies that are not broadly supported by the American people. It's one of the things we wanted to address in the bill that I co-authored, the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. And the other piece of this is campaign finance reform so that you have working class candidates running for Congress, for example, and for other federal office with a fighting chance at getting elected, despite the deluge of money that's going to be spent against them. So yes, big money is a problem in our politics. I'm proud to have in the past been endorsed by J Street, and to be primary approved in this election, and to have gone to the Middle East with J Street last November. And I have said before that I don't agree with endorsing people who tried to overturn the presidential election.
Great. I think we have time for a few questions from the chat. Ting?
Yes, okay. Joan Ma asks, what is the connection between the defense budget and the militarization of local police forces? And is that something that you as a congressperson can have an effect on?
Yes, it is something I can have an effect on. And it's not just in the defense budget. There are other programs that provide incentives for militarization of our local police, our municipal police forces. But, you know, one thing I've been trying to do is, frankly, in voting against the NDAA, that was one of my issues, one of several, by the way. There were a ton of terrible things in the NDAA. I don't think we should be, and I've supported legislation, by the way, providing excess military equipment from the federal government to local police forces. What the hell do they need military equipment for? And we've seen how those have been weaponized in Black and brown communities in particular. And so I think supporting legislation to constrain, if not outright eliminate, the provision of military equipment to local law enforcement by the federal government, using my platform, the role of...
So that is almost all of what Mondo Jones had to say at this forum yesterday. If people are interested, next week I'll provide a link to the entire forum. This is Arthur Schwartz signing off from Advocating for Justice. We'll be back next Thursday. Please, please, please donate to WBAI. Please, please, please go to vote next Tuesday. There's a governor election, a lot of assembly elections, state committee elections. Please go to vote. It's very important. Elections matter. And, you know, I may be an old fogey, but I'm going to end this show with Bob Dylan and The Times They Are Changing.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
And if you want to keep up with the changing times, you need WBAI, listener-sponsored radio, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And as you've been hearing for the last week or so, we are in the middle of our June Tower Fund drive to pay for the back rent where the transmitter is housed in Four Times Square. and to pay the rent in 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, where I am currently seated in our studios, bringing in programs from all over the city and beyond. Coming up in a moment, Basir Amchaoui with Education at the Crossroads. But if you'd like shows like that to continue, or Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz to continue, well, I need a home to broadcast from, that home, WBAI. Please call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to make a tax-deductible contribution to the Tower Fund. Become a member of WBAI for as little as $25. You can also pledge online. Go to WBAI.org. Look for the Tower Fund box to click on. And you can make a donation online. Otherwise, you can call our operators, 212-209-2950.